So welcome to our game discussion section. We're going to be talking about Dark Heresy again today. And once again, as I mentioned before, particularly the second edition version of Dark Heresy. So we both had a chance to properly download and fully read the book. So before we get into the actual meat of what it's all about, Mike, first impressions of second edition beta for Dark Heresy. What do you reckon?
I don't have enough pictures.
No, no.
No, seriously. Obviously, it's a downloaded beta version. They haven't got any artwork in it. There's a lot of sections cut out where they haven't included that details because it's not relevant.
Not relevant for the playtest.
Mostly it's fluff sections about the actual sector, about what the Inquisition is and what acolytes are and what they do. Obviously, they assume that whoever's going to be running this beta and giving feedback is already well aware of these things, and that's totally fine. I have no problems with that. For the rules point of view, I think that it's well set out. They've cleaned up a lot of things. Obviously, there's still quite a few bits that need to get fixed, and that's why they're doing this beta.
That's it. I mean, predominantly, the core system is actually mostly the system behind Black Crusade and Only War. And that's, of course, by design. So we have mentioned it before, but the second edition of the beta has sort of had a... It's version 2 of the beta, because there was a version 1 where the system was quite different from the earlier 5 systems. And I think there was some concern in the community about compatibility. And for whatever reason, the decision was made to change to a system more in line with Only War and Black Crusade being the most recent versions of the system. And lots of people have lots of opinions on that they're all very willing to share at length on the forums.
Yeah, so I think it's fair to say there's not really any point us discussing the version 1 of the beta, because it's what they've decided not to go with. Really, if they've decided not to go with it, it's pros and cons completely pointless.
That's it. This podcast isn't our opinion of the decision. This podcast is our opinion of what we've been given to work with, which is version 2 of the second edition beta.
And in all, I think it's a good version.
That's it, yeah. So, give you an example, it incorporates the aptitude system from Only War rather than the rank system from the old Dark Heresy, which we talked at length about in our last episode, but I think that it works a lot better here. I certainly didn't feel that there weren't enough aptitudes as I felt in Only War.
I think the main advantage for the aptitude system in this version of the game is that you do get some on places other than your final career decision. So your home world gives you one, which branch of
your background,
your background gives you one as well. And that gives you a little bit more freedom to customize your character as you see fit. And it means that every single seeker or every single mystic isn't going to be exactly the same for aptitudes.
That's it. I mean, in Only War, you pretty much got all your aptitudes from your speciality. You may get one, maybe a second one from your regiment, if that's the way it's been created. And whereas here, you're guaranteed those other two outside of your role.
Exactly, and I felt that made a real problem, especially for if you were playing a campaign of Only War, of, say, everyone being a Stormtrooper, which is a very valid choice. You could play a Stormtrooper squad, in which case everyone has exactly the same aptitudes, exactly the same abilities. You're all from the same homeworld, so same regiment, everything's the same. Your characters will be the same up until they start spending experience. And I think that this system, with a bit more choice on where that stuff comes from, is a much better way of doing it.
All right. So let's start with the characters in general, because this is where the major changes in the beta are, from Dark Heresy originally, and also from the other systems. So in the characteristics, they've all remained the same, except now they've added an influence characteristic. So influence was incorporated into first edition Dark Heresy with Ascension. But influence in that case was a single score for the entire group.
Yes.
And it represented where a group that had ascended, where their power sat. It was similar to acquisition in Rogue Trader. You could use it to acquire goods. Did it have any other uses in Ascension, Mike, that you can recall?
You could use it in Ascension for dealing with other branches of the Administratum and Imperial Machine as a whole. So calling in favours, getting things done. And also, I believe, with certain talents, you could use it for things like creating groups of acolytes to send out and do missions, and things like that. So it did have other uses other than just simply buying gear, but they were limited.
That's it. And influence in the second edition beta is actually a per character stat.
Yes, which I personally prefer it as a per character stat.
Yeah, I mean, when I first saw it, my concern was that you're going to have one character who ends up buying everything. And there was even a sidebar to that effect in the beta as well. But, Mike, you had some thoughts on that, didn't you?
Well, the simple fact is that happens in most games anyway. Whichever game you're playing, there will usually be someone who is better skilled at purchasing things for the group.
Simply richer sometimes.
Sometimes it's simply because they've got more money. Other times it's because their character class is geared that way. They may be some sort of fixer or gatherer of goods or a black marketeer or whatever, depending on the game system and the character classes out there. And they're going to be the person who goes out and buys the goods. I mean, perfect example would be D&D. If someone wants to get hold of some poison, your cleric isn't going to be the person going and buying it, regardless of who's going to use it in the end. Your thief will probably be the person who goes out, deals with the underworld, and buys some poison.
That's it. And also, the influence stat in this version also has some additional uses. Similar to Ascension, you can use it to acquire not only the items, but also resources. And even use it in some social tests as well, where, you know, your influence or your character's history and background may have an effect on whether or not someone will actually help you with something or give you something.
Absolutely. And I mean, it wouldn't be a proper game if one of the noble characters didn't say, "Do you know who I am?"
That's it. And as it'll be mentioned in our interview later on, but one thing you could also use it for potentially is when you've got a couple of characters who are vying for a position or who are competing with each other for something, and it can sort of be used as a way to work out which one has more favour or which one has more pull with the Inquisition.
Yes, yes.
All right, so in addition to the characteristics, the big change with character creation is this three-choice system. So every character has a homeworld, every character has a background, which Imperial Institution they came from, and every character has a role. And the role, for the most part, is the thing they've been selected to do within the retinue. So how do you find this three-choice system, Mike?
I find it is a middle ground, really, between the original, which was just a homeworld and a career, and the Rogue Trader system, which had its whole long life path system with moving down the tree. And I feel that this is a nice, happy medium ground. You get to choose where you're from, where you worked, and what you did in that job.
Yeah, so certainly, you don't build characters with a lot of stats, like a lot of skills, a lot of talents, and this was sort of observed in our playtest. And also, originally the first version of the beta came out with stats starting at 25 plus 2d10, and that dropped down to 20 in one of the later changes. And I'd say probably one of the reasons is that FFG want to maintain a level of compatibility between characters created with Dark Heresy 2nd Edition beta, or 2nd Edition when it comes out, and where Dark Heresy characters were previously for incorporation into cross-game or cross-genre games.
Yes.
So you've got this whole thing where a Dark Heresy character started with 500 XP and a Rogue Trader character started with 5,000, and the variance in that XP starting was in order to indicate what power level they were comparable on. And I think if they keep this lower skill, lower talent, 20 on the starting stats, then they're going to keep that same balance there.
Yes, yes. And it's actually mentioned in the discussion held by the group after the playtest. One of the players points out, I believe it was Lee pointed out, that Acolytes are towards the lower end of the spectrum of ability of these institutions. They're not going to send a squad of the best out when there's a risk that they could all get wiped out with absolutely no gain, or it could be a complete waste of time. They're going to send out people who aren't necessarily well-skilled, not just because they don't want to waste them in case it's a mistake, but also because the Inquisition favours teaching people new sets of skills. And if you've got someone who's served 70 years in the Imperial Guard, it's going to be very difficult for them to stop thinking like a guardsman and start thinking like an Inquisitor. Whereas if you've got someone who's only been at it for a short time, you can change their mindset.
So I think the vast majority of Acolytes as well are regarded as expendable until they've sort of proven themselves over several missions too.
Yes, yes, definitely.
So, yeah, I didn't see a problem with them being entry-level character. I think it fits the Dark Heresy mold quite well. It does have the same problem that Dark Heresy's always had, which is when you start playing the game, you know, your characters have skills in the 30 to 40% range, which means they'll actually fail more often than they'll succeed. It's part of the flavour of Dark Heresy. It's a bit unusual for new players coming in from other systems, but you know, it's just the way Dark Heresy is.
I think in those situations, really, players should be looking for all the bonuses they can. You wouldn't expect someone who's fresh to the Inquisition to just happen to know all about Wraithbone and Elder Soulstones just off the top of their head through Forbidden Lore Xenos Elder. But if they've got all the books there, and they've got Forbidden Law, Elder Xenos, and they can get a bonus of plus 20 for having the books there, because they actually know what they're looking for, then it's great. And that is really the way it should be. They shouldn't just happen to know everything off the top of their heads.
That's it. Now, when we went through the character creation process, we certainly found that there is some balance required still in the, especially in the home worlds. Like,
yes,
we had two people create hive welders in the playtest, and so hive welders get their special abilities being not treating crowds as difficult terrain, and giving a bonus to navigate surface roles in enclosed terrain. They get two fate points with a chance of a third, and that's really where they stop.
Yep.
Now compare that to, say, Voidborn. So Voidborn get Strong-Minded for free, which is technically a talent that requires resistant psychic powers only. They get that for free.
Yeah, it's a level 2 talent.
And they get a choice of Jaded or, I think it was Light Sleeper.
Jaded or a different one, I can't remember.
It's a choice of two talents on top of Strong-Minded.
Yes.
And then they get three fate points with a chance of a fourth, and a very high chance of a fourth.
Yes.
So,
and there's only a difference of one wound between the two homeworlds as well.
That's it. See, the homeworlds in first edition Dark Heresy often had drawbacks. So, for example, Voidborn had penalties on social skills because they were just creepy. And there are actually no negatives to any of the choices that you have in this book. Between homeworld, background, role, there's no negatives. They're all bonuses.
Yes. I'd like to point out that I don't think they should be bringing negatives in. I just think they
need
a
better balance.
Just need a better balance of the for the hive world advantage. And I think probably it would simply be a case of saying that a hive worlder can move through any occupied space as a free action.
That's it.
Or without penalty. So if you've got a group of allies in combat, the hive worlder can move through the same squares they're in if you're using maps or whatever, and get into position easier. And I think that would probably be a simple balance. But the other problem is the navigate surface roles inside a building. I think they need to fix that a little bit as well. That's a bit of a lame advantage.
Bit of a naff power, that's it.
It is. It comes across as a little bit naff.
Yeah, I'm sure that there'll be more balancing done over time. But that's just what we found in our version of it. So the background. So you basically got a choice of six Imperial institutions. So Adeptus Arbites, Administratum, Ministorum, Mechanicus, Astra Telepathica, Imperial Guard. And you've got an extra one, which is Outcast, so someone not from an Imperial institution. This came up due to bring our playtest. What do you think of the fact there's only one choice to not be from an Imperial institution?
I'd like to point out that just because it's called Imperial Guard doesn't mean it's necessarily an Imperial Guardsman. They could be a PDF trooper, they could be a mercenary from a noble house's family. They're going to have the same sort of training, they're going to have the same sort of skills, they're going to have the same sort of abilities. It's just simply a case of fluff naming it something else, and I don't think it's really a problem.
Okay, I mean, someone did raise in the playtest as well that, realistically speaking, the Inquisition is going to recruit people from primarily Imperial institutions anyway. So
yeah, absolutely.
Outcast characters will make up the minority of acolytes as it is.
As they should.
Yeah, and we did find, so one of the characters created was a Voidborn Outcast Mystic, so an unsanctioned psyker. And given that you get your gear from the role, it seemed a bit odd that the character got a chainsword and a las pistol and no psi focus. They didn't get the Sinisient skill because the skills, primarily the starting skills, come from your background. I mean, all these things can be bought with XP, and gear changes over time.
That's true, but I have to point out Gaunt's Ghosts, I believe it's in. There's a character in that which is an unsanctioned psyker who receives prophetic messages written on things. He doesn't even know he's a psyker. Why would he have a psi focus?
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, psi focus, if you really want to start with one,
take it as a starting gear pick. That's it.
Problem solved.
And of course, your roles are more sort of open-ended terms to describe the position you play within the acolyte group. So
yep.
Things like warrior, seeker, sage, hierophant, mystic. These are all the sort of roles you have. And the roles will largely control how your character develops from then on, because that's where the majority of your aptitudes come from, which affect your experience gains.
Yes.
One of the things I thought about the first Dark Heresy game was, it was odd that, say you make an Imperial Guard character, all the options available to your character through the rank system are Imperial Guard advancements. It assumes that even though your character is now working for the Inquisition, doing entirely different things to what they would have done in Imperial Guard, they are continuing to develop skills as though they were remaining in the guard.
Yes.
So it's arguable as to whether these characters go back to their day job in between missions because they all still draw an income from their day job.
Yeah, that was something which struck me as very odd. I have to agree with you there. It doesn't make much sense that the Inquisition would trust an Imperial Guardsman who's been out killing demons to go back to his squad and not act differently and say things he shouldn't say. They seem like a very paranoid group, and I doubt they would send them back to work with their friends again.
That's it. So, I mean, using this new aptitude system, you know, no matter what the skill or talent or anything, you can buy whatever you want for your character. The aptitudes simply control how much it costs. They just give you an idea that the character is naturally suited towards learning certain abilities because of their past and because of the role they play on a day-by-day basis. But you're not limited to what you can or can't buy.
Yes.
Yeah, so I think the system actually works quite well, and I was quite happy with that sort of setup.
Yeah, so I like the new aptitude system, the way it's presented here, a lot better than I do in Only War, simply because there's a bit more freedom in the system because it's less role-dependent upon what you are. Like, not all medics are going to be the same because they're going to be from different homeworlds, from different institutions, all these things.
All right, so once you've got your homeworld, that's the first point you can actually do characteristics because your homeworld has two pluses and a minus. So if you're using the rolled system, this means that if you have a plus, you roll an extra dice and take the best two. If you have a minus, you roll an extra dice and roll and keep the worst two.
I would recommend that if you're playing in a game and your games master wants to make it rolled characteristics, that you choose your homeworld, you roll your characteristics, then you decide what you want to play. Because otherwise you're going to run into situations where you may only have 23 ballistic skill, 23 weapon skill, and you've selected to play an Imperial Guardsman.
Yeah, or warrior.
Yes.
That's it. So, I mean, a lot of GMs will usually give you some leeway when it comes to roll systems of saying, okay, you can re-roll the lowest, and it does say you can pick one to re-roll in the rules.
Yes, yes.
But they may let you swap stats, for example, and of course the problem here is that because you have a different number of dice per stat, and each stat is declared by the homeworld, moving them back and forth doesn't really work as easily as that.
Yes, but we mentioned it before the show, but we were talking about what we're going to discuss here. Character creation is probably the most personal thing a GM will lay their hands on. Every GM will do it slightly differently. This is only really an issue if your GM is strictly by the book and they follow every rule through character creation exactly as presented without any room for manoeuvrability.
That's it.
And that isn't very common.
I mean, my personal preference, I've always preferred point-buy systems for the pure reason that it means there's no complaints about I got bad stats. You know, every character is equal and fair and will develop differently, but at least you all start off on equal footing.
I disagree a bit with that because there's always been balance issues in this game.
Well, I mean, there's min-maxing. That's always a risk as such, but you can't argue whether or not they're
it takes luck out of the equation.
And it also takes cheating out of the equation, I've got to say. I mean, it is true. Wherever you have competitive players and wherever you have dice rolled situations, there is always the risk that people will fake dice rolls, will, you know, try and use a bit of sleight of hand, will just say, oh, I rolled a 10 when they've already picked up their dice. You know, we've had friends that have done it in the past.
Yes.
And that gets rid of that. I mean, when we ran the Unbound, because we had about sort of 60 players playing there, we needed to ensure that there was something, we were consistent, you know, in all the rules. And so we had fixed characteristic, the point buy system, and we had, I think, maximum for fate and wounds in that system as well.
Yes.
Individual GMs have their own preference. That was ours at the point in time. If I was going to pick up and run Dark Heresy beta as it appears now, I'd probably go with point buy, but I'd still allow the role for fate and the role for wounds.
Yes.
Especially because the new Emperor's Blessing system means that giving someone automatically maximum fate points skews the balance of the homeworlds.
Yes, yes. Now, I think it's important to point out that they've gone back to a wound system which isn't double-dipping your toughness. So
how toughness doesn't actually apply to your wounds.
Yeah, yes. So with Rogue Trader, it used to be double your toughness bonus plus a D10 for wounds or D5 for wounds. Now it's a set number for your homeworld plus a D5.
Yeah.
And I feel that's a better system because otherwise it encourages toughness to play too much of a role.
Well, that's it. I mean, your toughness removes from any wounds that you take anyway. So if you have a wound system based on your toughness, then you've got more wounds from being tough and you take less damage.
Yes, it's how I'd equate a combat system which involved your armor affects how easy it is to hit you, and it reduces your damage as well. It's double dipping.
Exactly. So I don't have a problem with the current wound system.
For a balanced system, I think the reversion to the older system of homeworld determining your wounds is better.
Now, speaking of fate points, so the way it works in this version is that you have a fixed starting fate value for your homeworld, and you have something called Emperor's Blessing, where each homeworld will have a dice code, say, for example, 7+. You roll a d10, if you get 7 or higher, you have one more fate point. Now, some homeworlds, for example, we mentioned before, Hive Worlds, have 2 with a 9+, so they have to roll a 9 or 10 to get to 3, whereas Voidborn have 3 with a 3+. So on a 3 or higher, they've now got 4 fate points.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with the bonus fate point as such.
I like the system they've used to make sure everyone's around the same level for that homeworld. I mean, having any fate at all marks you out as distinctly above the rest of humanity. Most people have 0 fate.
Yeah.
So obviously having any fate is a huge advantage. But I have to say, I think there's a bit too much leeway between some homeworlds giving you 2 and some homeworlds giving you 4. I would have liked to have seen that gap narrowed a little bit. So I like the way they've gone about it, but I think they needed a bit more balance in the homeworlds for fate.
Something I've certainly done in the past is I've made the mistake of being too generous with fate point awards, like giving additional fate points. And in our Dark Heresy campaign around for several years, I think at one point I had a character that ended up with 6 or 7 fate points. And it just became unbalanced in the game because there was no real threats to the character. Any sort of major thing, they'd just spend a fate point to avoid or change, or if they got killed, they'd burn a fate point.
Absolutely, and you do have to be careful of that because there is the option then of if... It's like having multiple lives. Sometimes people will do suicidal or risky things simply because they know they've got a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Yeah, things that shouldn't work.
Exactly.
That's it. And because the problem there is that some people had low fate points and they did something which I felt was climactic in the game. So I said, okay, you've just defeated this major boss. Everybody have a fate point, you know. And of course, the people that hadn't burned their fate points were just getting more and more and more. So there are lots of sidebars in this beta that basically say be very careful with giving people additional fate points. And certainly something I'd probably do as a GM if I was running this game as a campaign would be to say, okay, you know what your starting fate threshold was. If you burn fate points, you can go back to your threshold, because when you burn a fate point, effectively you lower the threshold. But the starting threshold, I'd actually use as that player's or that character's maximum potential fate as such.
I know, I'd probably go for a maximum fate of about 6. Okay. So you can never go above 6, no matter who you are, unless that you have some spectacular talent. I believe there's an Inquisitor talent which lets you increase your fate. Unless you're willing to spend the 1,000 XP or whatever it is to buy something like that, you can't get your fate above that number. I'd probably say it's the same for everyone, whatever this maximum cap is. Might be 5, for example. In which case, a Voidborn is closer to that cap at the start, but they're not going to get unduly advantaged by always having a higher fate threshold than everyone else.
Yeah. I mean, in any case, the book is pretty clear that you need to be very careful with awarding fate points. And that's
absolutely
something that,
yes,
I've had to learn the hard way. It can really unbalance a game. All right, so in addition to your 3 key choices, your homeworld, background, and role, your character can actually also acquire elite advances. And whereas elite advances in the old edition referred to buying abilities outside of your progression chart, here they're effectively alternate careers. So the book has 3 elite advances in it. It has Inquisitor, it has Untouchable, and it has Psyker. So they all require XP to buy, although you can get Psyker for free if you've taken the Mystic role. Generally speaking, they'll add a couple of special abilities to your character. They may add a talent or an aptitude. And basically, these are your alternate careers. I suspect that what will happen in the future is when they bring out additional splat books, there'll be new elite advances. There'll probably be new homeworlds and new backgrounds. I think the roles should probably stay the same.
I think it's going to be difficult to add additional roles. I view roles very similar to the way that MMOs would view essentially the roles in that, DPS, healer, tank, whatever. You can't really add additional roles because there are only so many roles in an actual game.
Yeah. The best example I could give would be looking at 3rd edition Dungeons & Dragons, where you're basically your fighter, wizard, rogue, cleric, you know, those core classes were the only sort of real starting classes. You had hundreds of prestige classes. Yes. And yes, they did introduce a whole bunch of other base classes like Swashbuckler and War Mage down the track, but you know, your core classes were pretty much consistent. And I think that'll be the same with roles. I hope it's the same.
Hopefully it's going to be the same
roles. But yeah, I'd certainly say I'd really like to see some more elite advances.
Yes.
I mean, this, I think I'd like to see some more homeworlds. Like, I think definitely Skull of Virginium needs to appear at some point in a later book.
Yes.
I
think homeworlds is definitely going to be something they add. And I think backgrounds they'll probably add quite a few more to as well. Hopefully, though, as you said, roles they'll keep the same.
Certainly one of the topics I saw discussed on the FFG forums for the beta was ideas that different players had for incorporating Adeptus Sororitas back in after they were used in first edition. And some people said, okay, they need a Skull of Britannium homeworld, an Adeptus Sororitas background, and a Battle Sister role. And I had a look through the materials, and I thought, for example, if I was going to do it, I'd certainly drop out Battle Sister as a role and sort of incorporate
a warrior
or something like that. You know, you could probably even do it, realistically speaking, with Adeptus Ministorum, because if you think about it, all these Dark Heresy characters are, as we said before, they're entry-level characters. You know, bringing a Battle Sister in...
It's going to massively unbalance
the game. That's it. I'd rather do what they did with Inquisitor's Handbook and say that, you're fine, you can want to play Adeptus Sororita, that's fine, but it's a novitiate. You know, it's someone who is just studying to achieve that level of involvement as such. So.
Exactly. I mean, you're playing characters who are acolytes. You're not playing characters who are the Inquisitor's direct henchman and retinue, and actually there with the Inquisitor. Not necessarily. Maybe they are. Maybe it's a junior Inquisitor. Maybe it's an Inquisitor who doesn't like having powerful retinue. But really, I think those things aren't suited for an acolyte style of play.
So, I mean, look at the war game for a second. I haven't sort of looked too much into how retinue works in the current version of the game, but in the last version of the game, acolytes were pretty much just an extra wound with a special ability.
Yes.
So, you know, you have this thing here, you get +1 ballistic skill, and if you take a wound, you can say it's dead instead.
Yes.
You know, so that's really, that's what an acolyte is to an Inquisitor to some degree, is an extra wound. But, I mean, that's probably a gross look at it, but, you know, that's one thing to look at. Moving on from the characters to the skill section now. So the skill section has been much shortened from the original Dark Heresy, like the additions of Black Crusade and Only War were. Once again, they sort of changed up the rules about what skills you can or can't roll untrained.
Yes.
And the specification in the book is that you can only not roll specialist skills untrained. So specialist skills are any skill which breaks down into other skills. So, for example,
piloting.
Operate was actually, that's actually wrong, because operate you can actually roll untrained, because it is actually four individual skills.
Oh.
So if you look at the sheet, you've got common law, then you've got a whole bunch of blanks.
See, that makes no sense. Not anyone can just jump behind the controls of a helicopter, take off, and go for a fly.
Well, see, this actually came up in our playtest, because one of the characters opted to take one of the pieces of gear you can acquire is a motorbike, and they chose to have this motorbike. And then someone said, oh, but you haven't got operate ground, you know, so you've got to roll it agility -20, which was okay for the character. But then someone said, oh, but hold on a second, if it's a speciality skill, does that mean you can't roll it? Maybe I haven't read that one right, but definitely on the sheet at least, it breaks down into four individual skills rather than into a single operate skill with multiple blank lines underneath. It may just be because there's only four skills under it. They've just made it easy to write on the sheet.
Yes, yeah.
That one did come up.
We'll have to have a look at that.
That's it, yeah. But that, for example, would mean that Sinisians could be rolled untrained. This came up during our Black Crusade.
Yeah, so that's been mentioned in Black Crusade. It can be rolled untrained if you look at it the way they've got it there.
Red is written. I mean, that's a classic Games Workshop statement. Red is written.
Yes,
yeah.
It is. Again, I think the GMs are going to have to look at this and go, well, yes, no, and decide on the time. I mean, if someone walks into a room and there's a stench of ozone and brimstone and there's weird runes squiggling around on the walls, they may well be able to pick up that, yes, some sort of psychic power has been used.
Yeah. See, I've always liked the idea of common laws being rollable untrained, because they're common, you know.
Exactly.
So, I mean,
I have no problem with common laws being rolled. Otherwise, it just seems a bit strange of the who? The Administratum? Heard of them.
The Imperium? What is this Imperium you speak of?
Who's this Emperor guy you keep swearing to?
That's it. So, but I mean, They may look at that, but right now, specialty skills can't be rolled on trade. Everything else can.
Yeah.
The talent system hasn't really changed much. Obviously, lots of new talents, lots of new ways to do things. I do like there's a lot of talents that interact with the new systems we'll talk about later on, like the personality and the subtlety systems.
Yes.
I thought that was great. There were various ways to give characters control over that as well. But moving on from sort of character stuff, we're then getting into armory. And the big change I noticed here as part of the updates were that a lot of armors now have an agility bonus max. So they cap your agility bonus at, say, it came up in the beta. We had someone wearing feudal plate and their agility bonus was capped at 2, despite having a 40-something agility. Now, because it applies to the agility bonus, from my working, it only really affects movement speed and initiative.
Yes.
That's right, yeah.
So it shouldn't affect your dodge rolls.
Yeah.
It just means you're going to be reacting slower and running around slower,
yeah.
Which is okay. And it'll probably affect other talents as well. If there's a talent which says you can attack this many people or you can dodge this many times according to your agility bonus, in those situations it'll affect it as well.
That's it.
I think that's probably a good thing. You don't really want to see too many assassins in power armor.
Yeah, I think it was something that the system was missing until now.
Yeah. I think the big test will be when eventually they update to Death Watch 2nd Edition.
How they handle Marines in this case, yeah.
Exactly, because really Marines, their power armor is an extension of their body. For everyone else who don't have the Black Carapace enhancement, it's not. Yeah. So I think that as a system it'll work well.
Okay, yeah. So after gear we have psychic powers, or psychic abilities, and the big change here is that psychers now buy their powers through these progression charts. So they're sort of like flow charts. They control the order in which you buy powers. A lot of them have... One thing I did really like is a lot of the powers had a statistical requirement, or characteristic requirement, that wasn't willpower. So, you know, if you wanted to be a... Biomancer, you know, a lot of the higher powers require a higher toughness, so you need to focus on toughness as well.
Yes.
Because in Dark Heresy, the first edition, it was harder to acquire new disciplines, and so you had your minor powers, you had your discipline powers, and every time you could acquire a discipline, you had a choice of either acquiring a new one or getting more powers from your current one. Here, you can buy any power at any time, provided you're up to it on the flowchart and you meet the requirements. So, I think that having these characteristic requirements stops characters from over-diversifying in the psychic powers.
Yes, and yeah. Also, to a degree, stops them over-specialising as well, because no longer do they have to go, well, I can either be really crap at a couple of things, or I can be really awesome at one thing. Now they can be medium at several things, which is probably better from a balanced point of view.
Yeah.
So, I prefer this version of the psychic system. I have to say that I think that the removal of minor powers is a bit of a shame. I believe it was only war. There's a minor power ability that you can purchase, which is essentially you can do things like make coins disappear and light cigarettes and things. It doesn't have any mechanical ability. It's just
prestidigitation, basically.
Essentially, yeah. Yes. And I think that they should have brought that in for this setting.
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, you made the comment early on that it's interesting that when you create a psychic character, you have your psi rating, but you don't have any psychic powers unless you buy some.
Yes. So I suppose you could say, well, I'm a psyker with a psi rating of 1, I'm unsanctioned, my ability is opening jars, so long as I am holding them.
Yeah.
So
something that doesn't need to be quantified in rules, basically.
Exactly.
It won't affect the
game. Which will give you access to psionicians, it'll give you access to minor things, and your character is going to try his absolute damnedest to make sure he doesn't get discovered, because there's not much chance of jar openers being sanctioned in the end. They're probably going to go off and feed the Emperor.
That's it. So, and it does actually have a nice little bit in this about how it works when you have an unsanctioned psyker in an Inquisitor's group. You know, the Inquisitor basically has authority to field sanction for the duration of their service to that Inquisitor.
So, yes, yes.
That was one of the weird things with the first edition of Dark Heresies. You had Adepts who suddenly managed to get Psi rating at rank 6 or rank 7. And how is that? Shouldn't they be getting on a black ship straight to Terra to be sanctioned? You know, they're gone for the next decade.
Yes.
So this thankfully has... It covers how that actually works in the context of the game and the Imperium. So, looking at a couple of changes to the core system, Mike, you found this one. Apparently being on fire sucks.
Yes. I'm sure we all remember the old system of being on fire. You take D10 damage each round, and for some characters with high armor and toughness, that's zero damage each round. They can carry on. They may fail their willpower roll and start rolling around on the floor, but other than that, they suffered no real ill effects.
Mm-hmm.
Now, every round you're on fire, you suffer a point of fatigue damage, which means eventually everyone passes out from being on fire unless they're completely immune to fatigue.
I mean, that's it. I mean, the fire's going to burn the oxygen out of the air, so...
Yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was like, I remember in Rogue Trader, you had the rule about a section catching on fire, and you had the choice of either sending teams down to firefight or just venting the section into space.
Always vent.
Yeah, because the problem was that if you failed the roll to
put the fire out... It could spread.
It destroyed the segment it was in, B, it spread to another segment, you know, so...
Yes.
And it was so destructive to your ship, it was easy just to blow the fire and the crew in that section out into space.
That's it, because you used to take morale damage for the fire for each section it burnt. And after it burnt two sections, it was more morale damage to let it keep burning than to blow the sections out into space. Because you suffer morale damage for jettisoning their friends into space as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, the crux of it is that when you're on fire, I think a game system needs to create incentive rules to get not on fire.
Yes. Being on fire sucks. Being not on fire rules.
Exactly. So, one of the systems they've introduced with Dark Heresy 2nd Edition that I love is subtlety.
Oh, definitely. The subtlety system is sorely needed. Our original Dark Heresy group was split very evenly down the middle with people who wanted to be subtle and people who didn't, and it led to a lot of conflict.
Yeah, I'll give you one example. The sort of one of the leading characters in the group was an arbitrator who had lost an arm to a crack grenade, and when he got a Cybernetic Army, he chose to have inquisitorial eyes stamped on each knuckle so that when he punched somebody, they'd know they were punched by the Inquisition. It's pretty hard to go undercover when you've got a, you know, black cyber arm with, you know, gold and silver inquisitorial eyes on the hand.
Yes, and it's also very difficult when your opening statement of going into every single room with every single person is, "We are the Inquisition."
Yes, exactly. So, subtlety is a mechanic which I think rewards characters or rewards players for playing through an undercover component of an investigation. Because, you know, there are advantages to keeping your presence as Inquisition unknown. First off, people might be more forthright with information. Secondly, the villains in the story, once they're aware of the Inquisition looking for them, they may do things like flee, destroy evidence, send killers after the Inquisitorial team. Yeah.
Or they may just stop what they're doing until the Inquisition goes away.
That's it, yeah, wait for it to blow over. Yeah. So, and the other thing I like about subtlety is it's double-edged. You know, there's a benefit to having too high subtlety, but there's also a drawback. And likewise, there's a benefit to a low subtlety, but also a drawback.
Yes, definitely. I like the way they've balanced the system, and I like the system of subtlety, pretty much all of it. I think it's a really well-put-together system.
Yeah, we did say before that there are a couple of talents that allow you to influence the subtlety system. And Mike, you were saying there is a way...
You can actually, because it's generally a hidden stat that the GM keeps hold of and the players don't actually know the subtlety of the group as a whole. There are methods that you can use to try and find out what your subtlety level is. But obviously, if you mess up those investigation roles to find out what your subtlety is, it raises people's notice of you and it decreases your subtlety. You know, going around to the bar saying, "So, have you noticed any inquisitors around here?" isn't the most subtle thing to do, especially if you screw it up.
Exactly. Now, another system that subtlety lends itself into is this new disposition and personality system. So, you as a GM can determine that a given NPC will have a particular disposition towards the characters based upon what they know of them. So if the characters have done a good job of keeping their subtlety high, the NPC may feel that they are something other than what they actually are and have a different disposition towards them. Or if they are aware they're inquisitors, they may have a more positive or more negative disposition. And once the players start interacting with that person, they'll quickly learn that the disposition will affect how helpful or how hostile the person is going to be. And they can use their various social skills to adjust that disposition either better or worse for whatever it is they were trying to do. I think that from my own point of view, and Mike, you may feel the same or differently, I've always liked to keep social interactions between player characters and NPCs something that I actually role play. So, okay, you want to ask the NPC questions? I'm here, I'm the NPC, you start talking, let's play it out. I know in some groups, some people like to roll rather than act.
Personally, I've always been of the opinion that you should roll first and then use your roll to influence the way that you role play it out. If someone rolls absolutely terribly, they should role play that they've messed it up.
See, I've always heard the opposite. I've always heard people say you should role play it out first, and the GM will assign you a bonus or a penalty based upon how well you role play that out.
Yeah, but that encourages people who are particularly poor at social interactions in real life not to even bother trying.
Yeah.
And those who are particularly good to not bother spending any points on those skills and just use their personal charisma to try and get them through it.
Yeah, I mean, there are always the two risks. One, the people who are not socially capable and who make characters that are, or people that who are socially capable and decide I'm going to dump stat charisma, or fellowship in this case, and just win with my own actual personality against the GM.
Yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you've got either of those problems, the disposition system, I think, is great for taking turning a charm roll into something that's actually quantifiable, has a given effect, you can basically say this is what's happened because you succeeded or failed that role.
Yes.
But I'd never like to replace, role playing with dice rolling when I can avoid it.
Exactly. Yeah, I think you're right there. I think you mention it in the discussion of the beta with the players. It's also very good for interrogations, intimidation, anything like that.
Anything where the interaction is generally it's uncomfortable as well. You know, some people don't like playing out harming another person, interrogating somebody, threatening somebody. They're getting uncomfortable with that sort of thing. So I think it's a good way to do that as well.
And also seduction. I can't imagine too many male players wanting to role play through seduction of a female character played by a male GM.
Yeah.
Can make players uncomfortable. Doesn't make all players uncomfortable, but it can make some players uncomfortable.
That's it.
So again, things where people may not be completely comfortable playing it out, I think it's a good system as well.
And I mean, even where I prefer to run these as a actors or a role play scenario, I can still use this system of disposition to track in the back of my mind. Okay, so I know that this NPC started off at this level of disposition. We've just role played it. I choose they go up to two levels or such, and I have given amounts of information the NPC will share based upon each level. So if I don't feel that the interaction was good enough to get three levels up, I may give less information than what they got from going two levels up. I can sort of have a framework in my mind and just use my personal ideas about the role playing to play with that.
Yes, yeah, I think it's a well put together system. I think it works for a variety of scenarios, but I think you're right. Any situation which can be role played out rather than rolling dice should be role played out.
That's it. Now, the book has a large section on investigation in general, and we'll be talking about this later on in the show, but I actually found this to be really helpful information. It was all about how to use clues and leads and those things to basically help a group. Because basically, Dark Heresy is a game of investigation.
Indeed, yes.
Yeah, I mean, if you wanted to play Ultraviolence, you've got games like Death Watch or Black Crusade. This is a game of subtle investigation, asking questions, following leads, finding the bad guy and perpetrating whatever it is you want to do against them as such. So I thought, I mean, it's not a rules thing. You know, you can't really beta test this. It was just really good advice on how to run investigations in a game.
Yeah.
Now, there were a couple of changes to corruption and mutation. So first off, you saw quite a big change to the mutation chart.
Yes, the very last choice of mutations, not last choice. If you roll a double zero for mutations, that power mutation is unbelievably powerful. And I think it really needs to be balance controlled, where essentially the character becomes part demon or possessed by the warp in some way. They're still a player character, but any characteristic role they make, they can substitute willpower in its place. Now, if you've got a psyker with a willpower of 50 or 60, that's going to make an unbelievably powerful PC.
Yeah.
So I would really recommend that a Fantasy Flight consider downgrading the power level of that particular mutation.
I mean, looking at the chart in general, all the mutations in this chart are much more overt than they were previously.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, you're talking about centauroid body, you know, extra limbs.
Whereas before it was, you know, their eyes go a little bit glassy, or they get a little bit warty, or their arms bend a little bit more than they used to. Now they've got, you know, snake-like lower bodies and extra heads and arms.
Personally, unless your GM chooses to put an extremely radical Inquisitor with your group, I don't see any character surviving getting any one of these mutations.
No, I don't think you could. I really don't think you could.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be more using these mutations for NPCs working out what they've got.
To be honest, I think probably this mutation chart's a step backwards from where it should be.
Mm.
Really, it should be a list of minor mutations, things like witches' nipples and, you know, marks of the demon upon their body or something, or a tiny little tentacle upon their, you know, lower back.
You still got malignancies, but malignancies are more sort of mental things, aren't they?
They're more an expression of corruption before a full-blown mutation.
Yeah.
And I feel that really the mutation chart is probably great for making mutants to fight against the group, but not so great for actually playing anything out.
That's it. The corruption system as well, I noticed, the system hasn't really changed, but the advice incorporated there sort of includes things like corruption traditionally was sort of used for warp shock, for psychic phenomena, for exposure to the warp. They've incorporated a couple of new things I noticed in this chart where they talked about things like reading forbidden tomes or comprehending forbidden law, or even potentially using the forbidden law skill sometimes.
Yes.
It reminds me a lot of the Call of Cthulhu insanity system, or the Cthulhu mythos skill in that, where the characters have come to comprehend something that shouldn't be comprehended.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, what did you think of the corruption changes?
I prefer the corruption changes.
Hmm.
I like the fact that they've included certain things which people may not consider a corrupt act, actually giving corruption. Obviously, you know, a serial killer who sacrifices every killing to corn is going to be picking up corruption along the way. But a serial killer who doesn't is still probably going to draw corn's notice eventually. It'll be much slower, but they will pick up corruption along the way. And I think it's a good idea to have it. Essentially, it's a morality scale.
Yeah.
And it can be role-played in that way, as the more corrupt a character becomes, the more corruption they pick up, the less flinching they are of doing things that need to be done, or, as the case may be, don't really need to be done, they just perceive need to be done.
I mean, in the current version of the game, there is no reason not to take forbidden laws.
Yeah.
You know, like they, all it does is give you an extra skill that you can roll on.
Yes.
And, you know, they're forbidden for a reason. There is danger in knowing this information.
Exactly. I mean, if you know how to summon a demon, there is the danger that eventually you may go, well, we can solve this problem by summoning a demon.
Yeah.
There doesn't seem to be any encouragement to go along that path in the current system. There's no reason a player ever would say, well, you know what? A demon could solve this problem. There's actually encouragement not to do that with the current system, whereas with the new system and corruption, you can say, well, you're corrupt now. Maybe you would start thinking that way.
Yeah.
Simply by knowing the knowledge of how to summon a demon, you start wanting to summon a demon.
Yeah.
I can. Why don't I?
Well, speaking of that sort of thing, there was a section in the book on reinforcements. So your characters get to the point where they decided that they can't solve an issue on their own. They're going to use their influence to try and bring in additional forces to assist them. Overall, I thought the section itself was quite good. My only complaint was that the examples they had for forces to call in were an Adeptus Sororitas Canoness, a Deathwatch Space Marine, an Eversaur Assassin, and a Grey Knight. Yeah, these are all pretty extreme examples of Imperial resources to call in on by an acolyte. You know, I'd be looking at things like maybe some Imperial Guard squads or a group of Arbiters. You know,
a group of five Stormtroopers would probably make a better example of a reinforcement choice than a Grey Knight. I mean, yeah, I have to say, the power level of the reinforcement examples they give is way over the top.
That's it.
Vastly over the top.
Yeah. Now, after that section, I actually had a bit on all the various adversaries. And I like the little stat blocks they've got now. They're sort of nice and easy to duplicate or put into your own adventures as well. But one thing the stat block incorporates now is a little number in the top right-hand corner, which is the threat level. So similar to challenge rating in Dungeons & Dragons, you can say that, okay, well, my group has... I've got six people with 1,000 XP, therefore I should have a 30 threat level on this encounter. And I can then pick and choose master monsters, or monster bad, master adversaries and regular line troops in order to build a 30-point threat encounter. And I know that encounter will be balanced for my group. What are your thoughts on this system?
I have absolutely no problem with it. I think it's a good tool to have an idea what they should be facing. I can understand a lot of people would be going, oh, well, as a GM, you should be able to pick up what your player should be facing. Well, yes and no, because some bad guys, which you may choose, on paper, are actually a lot weaker looking than they actually are. You know, a demon of Nurgle doesn't look that impressive on paper most of the time. But the diseases they carry with them have major long-lasting effects on characters, usually permanent stat loss. And while they may not be a particularly dangerous opponent, that permanent stat loss carries on with the character for the rest of their existence.
Yeah, and some things as well outside of that threat level will also adjust how challenging an encounter is. So
yep.
A demonic encounter is much more threatening when nobody in the group has a weapon that can get around demonic toughness.
Yes.
Yeah, and if everybody has one, it's a cakewalk all of a sudden.
Yes.
So even though the number itself hasn't changed.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's good for a framework, but not really much else. But as a framework, it's a very good tool.
One thing I will say is one of the problems I had with the various Dark Heresy modules, pre-written modules in books in the past, was I'd often say, okay, here is the encounter for Dark Heresy characters. Oh, and if your group is ascended, here is a tougher encounter. But there's a big difference between a rank 1 group and a rank 6 group, even though neither of those groups have ascended. You know, I certainly found that, you know, right before the group hit ascension, if they were rank 7, rank 8, and I'm putting in the non-ascended encounters, they would just absolutely decimate the opponents. And I think this system is quite good, because now what they can do when they do these pre-written modules is say, here are a couple of enemies that can appear in this fight, just use enough of them to fill up the threat level to what you want. You know, and if you want it to be a bit more challenging, go above the number. You want it to be a bit easier, go under the number.
Exactly. And with this same system, you can also balance combats to what your characters are. If everyone in your group is combat kitted out, or you've got one particular character who's kitted out with a powerful set of gear, they really know what they're doing, they know how to use the system, they know how to use combat, you can make the challenge a bit more dangerous. Whereas if everyone in the group is an investigator and a surgeon and adept, and absolutely no one can fight a damn, you're going to put in something a lot less powerful, and this is a good way of doing it.
That's it. And the last thing in the beta was the Seeds of Heresy module, which we decided to run with a playtest group. So our original plan was we were both going to go and I was going to run the game and Mike would play it with the playtest group.
Yes.
Unfortunately, Mike had his leave cancelled pretty much the day before, wasn't it?
Day before, yes.
The day before, that's it, yeah.
Yes, so the day before, the person called up and said, I can't cover this shift anymore.
Yeah, so it was just myself running the game. Mike has had a chance to listen to the interview, so anything you want to say before we jump into this interview, Mike?
It really sucks that I couldn't go.
Okay, no worries at all. So anyway, I want to first off thank the group of players that came along to participate. So it was Lee, Matt Lee, Sparky, Ben, Jeanette, and Damon. So thank you to that group for taking part. It is quite a long interview. We played through the full scenario. We did character creation. We had a few people try different things as well to make sure that we gave it a good workout. Unfortunately, the group is so roleplay heavy, they didn't get into a single combat. But with that being said, the combat system in Dark Heresy hasn't really changed that much from only War and Black Crusade. So that wasn't really required for the beta test. But we certainly did character creation. We did subtlety. We did disposition. So have a listen to the interview, see what you think, and we'll come back to you right after this.